out. "A bunch of spirited sluggers," said Herrenstein, "pounding an equine cadaver to smithereens." The two male-oriented groups overlapped considerably. Even in civilized message group company, tempers flared periodically. The acidic attacks and level of haranguing unique to online communication, unacceptably asocial in any other context, was oddly normative on the ARPANET. Flames could start up at any time over anything, and they could last for one message or 100. The finger controversy, a debate over privacy on the net, occurred in early 1979 and involved some of the worst flaming in the message group's experience. The fight was over the introduction, at Carnegie Mellon, of an electronic widget that allowed users to peek into the online habits of other users on the net. The finger command had been created in the early 1970s by a computer scientist named Les Ernest at Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab. "People generally worked long hours there, often with unpredictable schedules," Ernest said. "When you wanted to meet with some group, it was important to know who was there and when the others would likely reappear. It also was important to be able to locate potential volleyball players when you wanted to play, Chinese food freaks when you wanted to eat, and antisocial computer users when it appeared that something strange was happening on the system." Finger didn't allow you to read someone else's messages, but you could tell the date and time of the person's last logon and when last he or she had read mail. Some people had a problem with that. In an effort to respect privacy, Ivor Durham at CMU changed the Finger default setting. He added a couple of bits that could be turned on or off, so the information could be concealed unless a user chose to reveal it. Durham was flamed without mercy. He was called everything from spineless to socially irresponsible to a petty politician and worse. But not for protecting privacy. He was criticized for monkeying with the openness of the network. The debate began as an internal dialogue at CMU, but was leaked out onto the ARPANET by Dave Farber, who wanted to see what would happen if he revealed it to the outer world. The ensuing flame-fest consumed more than 400 messages. At the height of the finger debate, one person quit the message group in disgust over the flaming. As with the Quasar debate, the finger controversy ended inconclusively. But both debates taught users greater lessons about the medium they were using. The speed of electronic mail promoted flaming, some said. Anyone hot could shoot off a retort on the spot, and without the moderating factor of having to look the target in the eye. By the end of the decade, the message group's tone, which had begun stiffly, was an expansive free-for-all. Steferud always tried to get newcomers to introduce themselves electronically when they joined the group. When leaving, some bid farewell only to turn up again later at other sites. Only one or two people huffed off, quite ceremoniously, over a flame-fest or some other perceived indignity. One of the message group's eminent statesmen, Dave Crocker, sometimes probed the net with a sociologist's curiosity. One day, for example, he sent a note to approximately 130 people around the country at about 5 o'clock in the evening, just to see how fast people would get the message and reply. The response statistics, he reported, were a little scary. 7 people responded within 90 minutes. Within 24 hours, he had received 28 replies. Response times and numbers on that order may seem hardly noteworthy in a culture that has since squared and cubed its expectations about the speed, ease, and reach of information technology. But in the 1970s, it was an absolutely astonishing experience, Crocker said, to have gotten so many replies so quickly, so easily as that. On April 12, 1979, a rank newcomer to the message group named Kevin McKenzie anguished openly about the loss of meaning in this electronic, textually bound medium. Unquestionably, email allowed a spontaneous verbal exchange, but he was troubled by its inability to convey human gestures, facial expressions, and tone of voice, all of which came naturally when talking and express a whole vocabulary of nuances in speech and thought, including irony and sarcasm. "Perhaps," he said, "we could extend the set of punctuation in email messages." In order to indicate that a particular sentence is meant to be tongue-in-cheek, he proposed inserting a hyphen and parenthesis at the end of the sentence. Thus, the smiley face. Mackenzie confessed that the idea wasn't entirely his. It had been sparked by something he had read on a different subject in an old copy of Reader's Digest. About an hour later, he was flamed, or rather singed. He was told his suggestion was naive, but not stupid. He was given a short lecture on Shakespeare's mastery of the language without auxiliary notation. "Those who will not learn to use this instrument well cannot be saved by an expanded alphabet. They will only afflict us with expanded gibberish." What did Shakespeare know? Wink. Emoticons and smileys, smile, hoisted by the hoi polloi, no doubt, grew in email and out into the iconography of our time. It's a bit difficult to pinpoint when or why. Perhaps it was exhaustion, perhaps there were now too many new players in the message group, but by the early 1980s, note by note, the orchestra that had been performing magnificently and that had collectively created email over a decade began abandoning the score, almost imperceptibly at first. One key voice would fade here, another would drift off there. Instead of chords, white noise seemed to gradually overtake the message group. In some sense, it didn't matter. The dialogue itself in the message group had always been more important than the results. Creating the mechanisms of email mattered, of course, but the message group also created something else entirely, a community of equals, many of whom had never met each other, yet who carried on as if they had known each other all their lives. It was the first place they had found something they had been looking for since the ARPANET came into existence. The message group was perhaps the first virtual community. The romance of the net came not from how it was built or how it worked, but from how it was used. By 1980, the net was far more than a collection of computers and leased lines. It was a place to share work and build friendships, and a more open method of communication. America's romance with the highway system, by analogy, was created not so much by the first person who figured out how to grade a road or make blacktop or paint a stripe down the middle, but by the first person who discovered you could drive a convertible down Route 66 like James Dean and play your radio loud and have a great time. Chapter 8. A Rocket on Our Hands. Bob Kahn left BBN and went to work for Larry Roberts in 1972. He had deferred his arrival in Washington for a year to stay in Cambridge and plan the ICCC demonstration. Having spent 6 uninterrupted years focused on computer networking, he was now ready to make a clean break. He did not want to run a network project. So he and Roberts agreed that Kahn would set up a new program in automated manufacturing techniques. But Congress canceled the project before Kahn arrived. By now, ARPA had been changed to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. As Kahn once put it, the D had always been there, but now it was no longer silent. The name ARPANET remained. With the manufacturing project gone, Kahn was called back to the field in which he had grown expert, but he wanted to work on the newest experiments. The early 1970s were a time of intense experimentation with computer networking. A few people were beginning to think about new kinds of packet networks. The basic principles of packet switching were unlikely to be improved upon dramatically, and the protocols, interfaces, and routing algorithms for handling messages were growing more refined. One area still to explore, however, was the medium over which data traveled. The existing AT&T web of telephone lines had been the obvious first choice. But why not make a wireless network by transmitting data packets on the air as radio waves? In 1969, before Bob Taylor had left ARPA, he set up funding for a fixed-site radio network to be built at the University of Hawaii. It was designed by a professor named Norm Abramson and several colleagues. They constructed a simple system using radios to broadcast data back and forth among seven computers stationed over four islands. Abramson called it Aloha. The Aloha Net used small radios, identical to those used by taxicabs, sharing common frequency instead of separate channels. The system employed a very relaxed protocol. The central idea was to have each terminal transmit whenever it chose to. But if the data collided with somebody else's transmission, which happened when there was a lot of traffic, the receivers wouldn't be able to decode either transmission properly. So if the source radio didn't get an acknowledgement, it assumed the packet had gotten garbled. It retransmitted the packet later at a random interval. The Aloha system was like a telephone service that told you, after you tried to speak, and not until then, that the line was busy. Roberts and Kahn liked the general idea of radio links between computers. Why not do something still more challenging? Devise small portable computer sites carried around in vehicles, or even by hand, linked together in a packet-switching network. In 1972, Roberts outlined the scheme. He envisioned a network in which a central mini-computer situated in a powerful radio station would communicate with smaller mobile computer sites. Robert asked SRI to study the problem and work out a practical system. The concept of mobile computer sites held obvious appeal to the Army. Battlefield computers installed in vehicles or aircraft, moving targets, would be less vulnerable and more useful than fixed installations. Still, destruction of the single most crucial element, the stationary master computer in a centralized system, would take out a whole network. The need to defend against that danger was what had led Paul Barron to devise distributed networks in the first place. So from the standpoint of survivability and easy deployment, the packet radio network was conceived as a wireless version of the ARPANET, distributed rather than centralized. Over the years, the packet radio program was deployed at a handful of military sites, but technical problems made it expensive and it was eventually phased out. The limited range of radio signals made it necessary for packet radio networks to use relay sites no more than a few dozen miles apart. But a link above the Earth would have no such constraints. Such a relay would see almost an entire hemisphere of the Earth. While overseeing the packet radio projects, Kahn began to think about networks linked by satellites accessible over broad domains, to and from ships at sea, remote land-based stations, and aircraft flying almost anywhere in the world. By the early 1970s, many communication satellites, most of them military, were in orbit. Appropriately equipped, such a satellite could serve as a relay for communication. With the huge distances involved in satellite communications, signals would be delayed. The average trip for a packet to its destination would take about one-third of a second, several times longer than host-to-host delays on the ARPANET. As a result, packet satellite networks would be slow. Still, the idea that packet-switched networks and their attached computers could be linked by radio waves bounced from a satellite was appealing, not only to the American government, but also to Europeans, because transatlantic terrestrial circuits at the time were expensive and prone to error. The satellite network was dubbed SatNet. Researchers in the United States were joined by British and Norwegian computer scientists, and before long, satellite links were established to Italy and Germany as well. For a while, SatNet did well. In time, however, the phone company upgraded its transatlantic lines from copper to high-speed fiber-optic cable, eliminating the need for the more complicated SatNet link. The technical lessons of radio and satellite experiments were less significant than the broader networking ideas they inspired. It was obvious there would be more networks. Several foreign governments were building data systems, and a growing number of large corporations were starting to develop networking ideas of their own. Khan began wondering about the possibility of linking the different networks together. The problem first occurred to him as he was working on their packet radio project in 1972. "My first question was, how am I going to link this packet radio system to any computational resources of interest?" Khan said. "Well, my answer was, let's link it to the ARPANET, except that these were two radically different networks in many ways." The following year, another ARPA effort, called the Internetting Project, was born. By the time of the 1972 ICCC demonstration in Washington, the leaders of several national networking projects had formed an International Network Working Group, INWIG, with Vint Cerf in charge. Packet switching network projects in France and England were producing favorable results. Donald Davies's work at the UK's National Physical Laboratory was coming along splendidly. In France, a computer scientist named Louis Pouzin was building Cyclades, a French version of the ARPANET. Both Pouzin and Davies had attended the ICCC demonstration in Washington. "The spirit after ICCC," said Alex McKenzie, BBN's representative to the INWIG, "was, we've shown that packet switching really works nationally. Let's take the lead in creating an international network of networks." Larry Roberts was enthusiastic about INWIG because he wanted to extend the reach of the ARPANET beyond the DARPA-funded world. The British and the French were equally excited about expanding the reach of their national research networks as well. "Developing network interconnection technology was a way to realize that," said McKenzie. The INWIG began pursuing what they called a concatenated network, or CatNet for short, a transparent interconnection of networks of disparate technologies and speeds. The collaboration that Bob Kahn would characterize years later as the most satisfying of his professional career took place over several months in 1973. Kahn and Vint Cerf had first met during the weeks of testing at UCLA in early 1970, when they had forced the newborn ARPANET into catatonia by overloading the IMPs with test traffic. They had remained close colleagues, and now both were thinking extensively about what it would take to create a seamless connection among different networks. "Around this time," Cerf recalled, "Bob started saying, 'Look, my problem is how I get a computer that's on a satellite net and a computer on a radio net and a computer on the ARPANET to communicate uniformly with each other without realizing what's going on in between.'" Cerf was intrigued by the problem. Sometime during the spring of 1973, Cerf was attending a conference at a San Francisco hotel, sitting in the lobby waiting for a session to start when he began doodling out some ideas. By now, he and Kahn had been talking for several months about what it would take to build a network of networks, and they had both been exchanging ideas with other members of the International Network Working Group. It occurred to Cerf and Kahn that what they needed was a gateway, a routing computer standing between each of these various networks to hand off messages from one system to the other. But this was easier said than done. "We knew we couldn't change any of the packet nets themselves," Cerf said. "They did whatever they did because they were optimized for that environment. As far as each net was concerned, the gateway had to look like an ordinary host. Our thought was that, clearly, each gateway had to know how to talk to each network that it was connected to," Cerf said. "Say you're connecting the packet radio net with the ARPANET. The gateway machine has software in it that makes it look like a host to the ARPANET IMPs, but it also looks like a host on the packet radio network." With the notion of a gateway now defined, the next puzzle was packet transmission. As with the ARPANET, the actual path the packets traveled in an internet should be immaterial. What mattered most was that the packets arrive intact. But there was a vexing problem. All these networks, packet radio, SatNet, and the ARPANET, had different interfaces, different maximum packet sizes, and different transmission rates. How could all those differences be standardized in order to shuttle packets among networks? A second question concerned the reliability of the networks. the dynamics of radio and satellite transmission wouldn't permit reliability that was so laboriously built into the ARPANET. The Americans looked to Poussin in France, who had deliberately chosen an approach for Cyclades that required the hosts rather than the network nodes to recover from transmission errors, shifting the burden of reliability onto the hosts. It was clear that the host-to-host network control protocol, which was designed to match the specifications of the ARPANET, would have to be replaced by a more independent protocol. The challenge for the International Network Working Group was to devise protocols that could cope with autonomous networks operating under their own rules, while still establishing standards that would allow hosts on the different networks to talk to each other. For example, CataNet would remain a system of independently administered networks, each run by its own people with its own rules. But when time came for one network to exchange data with, say, the ARPANET, the internetworking protocols would operate. The gateway computers handling the transmission couldn't care about the local complexity buried inside each network. Their only task would be to get packets through the network to the destination host on the other side, making a so-called end-to-end link. Once the conceptual framework was established, Cerf and Kahn spent the spring and summer of 1973 working out the details. Cerf presented the problem to his Stanford graduate students, and he and Kahn joined them in attacking it. They held a seminar that concentrated on the details of developing the host-to-host protocol into a standard, allowing data traffic to flow across networks. The Stanford seminar helped frame key issues and laid the foundation for solutions that would emerge several years later. Cerf frequently visited the DARPA offices in Arlington, Virginia, where he and Kahn discussed the problem for hours on end. During one marathon session, the two stayed up all night, alternately scribbling on Kahn's chalkboard and pacing through the deserted suburban streets, before ending up at the local Marriott for breakfast. They began collaborating on a paper and conducted their next marathon session in Cerf's neighborhood, working straight through the night at the Hyatt in Palo Alto. That September, Kahn and Cerf presented their paper along with their ideas about the new protocol to the International Network Working Group, meeting concurrently with a communications conference at the University of Sussex in Brighton. Cerf was late arriving in England because his first child had just been born. "I arrived in mid-session and was greeted by applause, because word of the birth had preceded me by email," Cerf recalled. During the Sussex meeting, Cerf outlined the ideas he and Kahn and the Stanford seminar had generated. The ideas were refined further in Sussex, in long discussions with researchers from Davies and Poussin's laboratories. When Kahn and Cerf returned from England, they refined their paper. Both men had a stubborn side. "We'd get into this argumentative state, then step back and say, 'Let's find out what it is we're actually arguing about.'" Cerf liked to have everything organized before starting to write. Kahn preferred to sit down and write down everything he could think of, in his own logical order. Reorganization came later. The collaborative writing process was intense. Recalled Cerf, "It was one of us typing and the other one breathing down his neck, composing as we'd go along, almost like two hands on a pen." By the end of 1973, Cerf and Kahn had completed their paper, a protocol for packet network intercommunication. They flipped a coin to determine whose name should appear first, and Cerf won the toss. The paper appeared in a widely read engineering journal the following spring. Like Roberts's first paper outlining the proposed ARPANET 7 years earlier, the Cerf-Kahn paper of May 1974 described something revolutionary. Under the framework described in the paper, messages should be encapsulated and decapsulated in datagrams, much as a letter is put into and taken out of an envelope, and sent as end-to-end packets. These messages would be called Transmission Control Protocol, or TCP messages. The paper also introduced the notion of gateways, which would read only the envelope so that only the receiving hosts would read the contents. the TCP protocol also tackled the network reliability issues. In the ARPANET, the destination IMP was responsible for reassembling all the packets of a message when it arrived. The IMPs worked hard making sure all the packets of a message got through the network, using hop-by-hop acknowledgments and retransmission. The IMPs also made sure separate messages were kept in order. Because of all this work done by the IMPs, the old network control protocol was built around the assumption that the underlying network was completely reliable. The new transmission control protocol, with a bow to Cyclades, assumed that the CataNet was completely unreliable. Units of information could be lost, others might be duplicated. If a packet failed to arrive or was garbled during transmission, and the sending host received no acknowledgement, an identical twin was transmitted. The overall idea behind the new protocol was to shift the reliability from the network to the destination hosts. "We focused on end-to-end reliability," Cerf recalled. "Don't rely on anything inside those nets. The only thing that we ask the net to do is to take this chunk of bits and get it across the network. That's all we ask. Just take this datagram and do your best to deliver it." The new scheme worked in much the same way that shipping containers are used to transfer goods. The boxes have a standard size and shape. They can be filled with anything from televisions to underwear to automobiles. Content doesn't matter. They move by ship, rail, or truck. A typical container of freight travels by all three modes at various stages to reach its destination. The only thing necessary to ensure cross-compatibility is the specialized equipment used to transfer the containers from one mode of transport to the next. The cargo itself doesn't leave the container until it reaches its destination. The invention of TCP would be absolutely crucial to networking. Without TCP, communication across networks couldn't happen. If TCP could be perfected, anyone could build a network of any size or form. As long as that network had a gateway computer that could interpret and route packets, it could communicate with any other network. With TCP on the horizon, it was now obvious that networking had a future well beyond the experimental ARPANET. The potential power and reach of what not only Cerf and Kahn, but Louis Poussin in France and others were inventing was beginning to occur to people. If they could work out all the details, TCP might be the mechanism that would open up worlds. As more resources became available over the ARPANET and as more people at the sites became familiar with them, net usage crept upward. For News of the World, early net regulars regularly logged on to a machine at SRI, which was connected to the Associated Press newswire. During peak times, MIT students logged on at some other computer on the net to get their work done. Acoustic and holographic images produced at UC Santa Barbara were digitized on machines at USC and brought back over the net to an image processor at UCSB, where they could be manipulated further. The lab at UCSB was outfitted with custom-built image processing equipment, and UCSB researchers translated high-level mathematics into graphical output for other sites. By August 1973, while TCP was still in the design phase, traffic had grown to a daily average of 3.2 million packets. From 1973 to 1975, the net expanded at the rate of about one new node each month. Growth was proceeding in line with Larry Roberts's original vision, in which the network was deliberately laden with large resource providers. In this respect, DARPA had succeeded wonderfully. But the effect was an imbalance of supply and demand. There were too many resource providers and not enough customers. The introduction of terminal IMPs, first at MITRE, then at NASA's Ames Research Center and the National Bureau of Standards with up to 63 terminals each, helped right the balance. Access at the host sites themselves was loosening up. The host machine at UCSB, for example, was linked to mini-computers in the political science, physics, and chemistry departments. Similar patterns were unfolding across the network map. Like most of the early ARPANET host sites, the Center for Advanced Computation at the University of Illinois was chosen primarily for the resources it would be able to offer other net users. At the time Roberts was mapping out the network, Illinois was slated to become home to the powerful new Iliac 4, a massive, one-of-a-kind high-speed computer under construction at the Burroughs Corporation in Powley, Pennsylvania. The machine was guaranteed to attract researchers from around the country. An unexpected twist of circumstances, however, led the University of Illinois to become the network's first large-scale consumer instead of a resource supplier. Students on the Urbana campus were convinced the Iliac 4 was going to be used to simulate bombing scenarios for the Vietnam War and to perform top-secret research on campus. As campus protests erupted over the impending installation, university officials grew concerned about their ability to protect the Iliac 4. When Burroughs finished construction of the machine, it was sent to a more secure facility run by NASA. But the Center for Advanced Computation already had its IMP and full access to the network. Researchers there took quickly to the newfound ability to exploit remote computing resources. So quickly, in fact, that the center terminated the $40,000 monthly lease on its own high-powered Burroughs B6700. In its place, the university began contracting for computer services over the ARPANET. By doing this, the computation center cut its computer bill nearly in half. This was the economy of scale envisioned by Roberts, taken to a level beyond anyone's expectations. Soon, the center was obtaining more than 90% of its computer resources through the network. Large databases scattered across the net were growing in popularity. The Computer Corporation of America had a machine called Data Computer that was essentially an information warehouse, with weather and seismic data fed into the machine around the clock. Hundreds of people logged in every week, making it the busiest site on the network for several years. Abetted by the new troves of data, the ARPANET was beginning to attract the attention of computer researchers from a variety of fields. Access to the net was still limited to sites with DARPA contracts, but the diversity of users at those sites was nonetheless creating a community of users distinct from the engineers and computer scientists who built the ARPANET. Programmers helping to design medical studies could tie into the National Library of Medicine's rich Medline database. The UCLA School of Public Health set up an experimental database of mental health program evaluations. To serve the growing user community, SRI researchers established a unique resource called ARPANET News in March 1973. Distributed monthly in ink-on-paper form, the journal was also available over the net. A mix of conference listings, site updates, and abstracts of technical papers, the newsletter read like small-town gossip riddled with computer jargon. One of the more important items in the ARPANET News was the Featured Site series, in which system managers from the growing list of host computers described what they had to offer. In May 1973, Case Western Reserve University, which was selling computer services to network users, described its PDP-10 in terms that sounded altogether like an ad from the personal section. Case is open to collaborative propositions involving barters of time with other sites for work related to interests here, and sales of time as a service. Communicating by computer and using remote resources were still cumbersome processes. For the most part, the net remained a user-hostile environment, requiring relatively sophisticated programming knowledge and an understanding of the diverse systems running on the hosts. Demand was growing among users for higher-level application programs, aimed at helping users tap into the variety of resources now available. The file transfer and telnet programs existed, but the user community wanted more tools, such as common editors and accounting schemes. SRI's Network Information Center estimated the number of users at about 2,000. But a newly formed users' interest group, called USING, was convinced there was a gap between the design of the network resources and the needs of the people trying to use those resources. Envisioning itself as a lobby group, a consumers' union even, USING began immediately to draw up plans and recommendations for improving the delivery of computer services over the ARPANET. But DARPA saw no need to share authority with a tiny, self-appointed watchdog group made up of people the agency viewed as passengers on its experimental vehicle. The initiative died after about 9 months, with a terse memo from a DARPA program manager named Craig Fields, warning the group that it had overstepped its bounds. With neither funding nor official support for their effort forthcoming, members put USING into a state of suspended animation from which it never emerged. Other problems developed for DARPA as the profile of the network began to rise. Like the USING insurgency, most were relatively minor affairs. But together they illustrated the ongoing tensions related to DARPA's stewardship of the network. One area of tension had to do with DARPA's Pentagon masters. IPTO in particular managed to steer clear of the most blatantly military research. But while the Illinois students were wrong about the Iliac 4 being used for simulated bombing missions against North Vietnam, there were plans to use it for nuclear attack scenarios against the Soviet Union. Similarly, researchers of all sorts used seismic information stored on the Computer Corporation of America, CCA, database server, information that was being collected to support Pentagon projects involving underground atomic testing. In the late 1960s, growing political unrest, both violent and nonviolent, caught the U.S. military by surprise. Army intelligence knew all about Prague, Berlin, and Moscow, but now the Pentagon was contemplating Newark, Detroit, and Chicago. The Army gathered information from dozens of U.S. cities on the location of police and fire stations, hospitals, and so forth. Someone in the Pentagon thought it would be a good idea to keep track of local troublemakers as well. In 1972, public outcry erupted over the Army's information gathering, and the order went out for the files to be destroyed immediately. But 3 years later, allegations surfaced that Army intelligence officers had instead used the ARPANET to move the files to a new location. When the story broke, the fact that something like the ARPANET existed was news to most Americans. That the story was reported in the most draconian, cloak-and-dagger terms only added to the stormy reaction. The result was a Senate investigation in which DARPA was called upon to explain how it was using the ARPANET. DARPA eventually proved that the Army files had not moved on the ARPANET by reviewing hundreds of rolls of teletype printouts that had been stored in a dusty crawl space at BBN. DARPA was vindicated, but a perceived entanglement with the Army's clandestine operations was the last thing the ARPANET needed. Changes at DARPA. Discussions about how DARPA would ultimately divest operational responsibility for the network had already begun around 1971. DARPA had set out to link the core processing capabilities in America's top computer science research centers, and as far as the agency was now concerned, it had accomplished that. Its mission was research. It wasn't supposed to be in the business of operating a network. Now that the system was up and running, it was becoming a drain on other priorities. It was time for DARPA to shed the service provider's role. Handling the transition was a touchy matter. The ARPANET was now a valuable tool, and Roberts's goal was to ensure its continued development. He commissioned several studies to help determine the best option. The best route, it seemed, was to maintain a networking research effort but sell off the network itself to a private contractor. But sell to whom? The market for data communications networks was still largely uncharted, and the big communications companies remained as skeptical as ever about the DARPA technology. When Roberts contacted AT&T to see if it wanted to take over the ARPANET, AT&T formed a committee of corporate and Bell Labs staff and studied the idea for months. AT&T could have owned the network as a monopoly service, but in the end declined. They finally concluded that the packet technology was incompatible with the AT&T network, Robert said. Others were not so blind to the prospects of computer networking. In July 1972, three engineers left BBN to form a company that would market a commercial network called Packet Communications Incorporated. And BBN itself had spoken to Roberts about buying the network and setting up a subsidiary company to operate it. Small, specialized commercial carriers like these were the obvious solution to DARPA's problem. But soon, Roberts had a new problem. In early 1973, BBN recruited him to run a new subsidiary called Telenet, not to be confused with Telnet, the program for remote logins, which would market a private packet-switching service. Now, unable to recommend a sale by the government to Telenet, Roberts arranged to have the ARPANET transferred temporarily to the Defense Communications Agency, the same agency that Barron had refused to let build his network 10 years earlier. The generals and majors and captains were still only slightly more receptive to the idea of a packet-switch network than AT&T, but Roberts expected this to be only an interim arrangement. Having decided to accept the post at Telenet, Roberts now had the job of finding a successor. DARPA's Information Processing Techniques Office, however, no longer held the appeal it once had for those in academe. Roberts approached a couple of his principal investigators at universities, but people who had active research programs did not want to leave them. Others were concerned about the salary cuts they would have to take to come to the DARPA office. When Licklider heard of the trouble Roberts was having, he offered to return if Roberts needed him. Roberts knew it was a gesture on Licklider's part. Lick was now happily entrenched back at MIT. But after 6 months of searching, Roberts decided he didn't have a choice. When Roberts called Lick's office at MIT, he was told that Lick was on a walking tour in England. Roberts tracked him down in the middle of Wales and asked him if he was serious about taking the job. Licklider said yes. "I never saw Larry so overjoyed as when he finally got his replacement, because he was ready to go," recalled a colleague of Roberts. "I think some of his delight was also the fact that Lick was going to take it, because he liked him. Everybody did." One of the first problems Lick faced upon his return was an awkward one involving BBN, his one-time employer. BBN was refusing to release the IMP source code, the original operating program written by the IMP guys 5 years earlier. BBN's apparent impulse to control every aspect of the network created a certain tension from the beginning. Len Kleinrock and his group at UCLA's Network Measurement Center had found it particularly frustrating. The center's job was to find problems in the network, but when they did, BBN refused to help. "Whenever we found a software bug or inefficiency, we'd alert Hart specifically, and the response we got was typically almost a stiff arm," said Kleinrock. "He'd say, 'Look, the network is working. I've got a network to keep up and running, and we'll put your comment in the queue. We couldn't fix it ourselves because we didn't have the source code.'" The intellectual property issue finally boiled over when the engineers who left BBN to start their own company made a pointed request for their former employer to turn over the IMP source code. When BBN refused, they appealed to DARPA. While keeping source code proprietary is usually the prerogative of the company that develops it, the IMP source code was different, for it had been developed by BBN with federal funds. Moreover, BBN was in the midst of starting up the Telenet subsidiary, which would be competing with the company started by the engineers. There was some concern at DARPA that if anyone in Congress or the press corps latched onto the fact that BBN subsidiary and no one else had access to the Defense Department-sponsored IMP technology, the agency could have a major problem on its hands. Frank Hart and Dave Walden at BBN argued that since the source code was changed frequently to improve performance or fix bugs, the company was uncomfortable with distributing software that would become obsolete. The company held its ground. Steve Crocker, by then a DARPA program manager who oversaw most of BBN's contracts, took charge of the situation. He had control of about $6 million worth of work a year at BBN, about a quarter of the firm's gross revenues. I seriously considered moving all of the work we were supporting at BBN to other places, because we couldn't reach closure with them on the data rights to the IMP code, he said. And he let BBN know what he was thinking. Lick had had a long association with BBN, and he had a high regard for people there, but he was dismayed by their posture. Reaction throughout the computer community was much the same. Finally, in direct response to Crocker's threat, BBN agreed to provide the code to whoever asked for it, charging a nominal handling fee. This was just an early version of much more serious intellectual property rights issues that emerged across the industry over the next few decades, Crocker said. With Bob Kahn's help, Licklider also finished the job of spinning off the network to the Defense Communications Agency. Roberts's earlier probes into selling off the network notwithstanding, federal rules required that a resource as rich as the ARPANET couldn't just be sold to an outside party until the Defense Department determined whether it had a need for the net in defense. The agency eventually decided it did. In the summer of 1975, DCA took over the network management job from DARPA. Now DCA set operational policy for the network. DCA decided such things as where and when new nodes would be installed and what the configuration of data lines should be. And BBN retained the contract for network operations, which meant the company carried out the decisions made by DCA. Shortly after the transition had been made, Lick returned to MIT, where he would spend the remainder of his career. Soon, everyone at BBN noticed an increasing number of forms that had to be filled out, even for the smallest of jobs. The DCA bureaucracy rattled many of the university people, too. The agency generated a blizzard of memoranda from colonels and generals about things you were and weren't allowed to do, recalled Brian Reed. A few months after DCA took over the ARPANET, several of the graduate students in Stanford's computer science department came to a Halloween party dressed as colonels. Relieved of the day-to-day management chores, DARPA was now able to concentrate on developing the new CataNet protocols. By 1975, Yogan Dalal, a Stanford graduate student, had polished the transmission control protocol from Cerf and Kahn's 1974 paper into a set of concrete specifications. The TCP specification was sent to three separate places for concurrent implementation: BBN, Cerf's computer lab at Stanford, and University College, London. At about the same time, Kahn and Steve Crocker began talking to Cerf about taking a job as a DARPA program manager in Washington. "I flew there and landed in a big snowstorm and thought, I don't want to live in this part of the country," Cerf recalled. "So I said no. But the real reason was I was afraid I wouldn't do a very good job. I thought it would be a very visible position, and if I screwed up, everybody would know." A year later, Kahn and Crocker tried again. This time, Cerf accepted. "I was getting a little tired of being so fragmented at Stanford. I couldn't get any research done. So I thought, why not go to DARPA and have a bigger impact? Because instead of the small little budgets I got at Stanford for my work, at DARPA I'd have an opportunity to have a bigger impact with more money to spend." As a program manager, Cerf was given responsibility for the packet radio, packet satellite, and research programs in what was now simply called the ARPA Internet. Cerf also continued working intensively on refining the TCP specification. A milestone occurred in October 1977, when Cerf and Kahn and a dozen or so others demonstrated the first three-network system with packet radio, the ARPANET, and SatNet, all functioning in concert. messages traveled from the San Francisco Bay Area through a packet radio net, then the ARPANET, and then a dedicated satellite link to London, back across the packet satellite network and across the ARPANET again, and finally to the University of Southern California's Information Sciences Institute, ISI, in Marina del Rey. The packets traveled 94,000 miles without dropping a single bit. During a break from a meeting Cerf chaired at ISI to discuss TCP in early 1978, Cerf, Postel, and Danny Cohen, a colleague of Postel's at ISI, got into a discussion in a hallway. "We were drawing diagrams on a big piece of cardboard that we leaned up against the wall in the hallway," Postel recalled. When the meeting resumed, the trio presented an idea to the group. "Break off the piece of the transmission control protocol that deals with routing packets, and form a separate Internet Protocol, or IP. After the split, TCP would be responsible for breaking up messages into datagrams, reassembling them at the other end, detecting errors, resending anything that got lost, and putting packets back in the right order. The Internet Protocol, or IP, would be responsible for routing individual datagrams." "I remember having a general guideline about what went into IP versus what was in TCP," Postel recalled. "The rule was, do the gateways need this information in order to move the packet? If not, then that information does not go in IP." This twist on the protocol was inspired by a group of engineers from the Xerox Corporation's Palo Alto Research Center, who had attended the Stanford seminar. The Xerox team had solved similar issues on a smaller, proprietary scale by defining a family of protocols called the PARC Universal Packet, or PUP. Once Postel decided that creating a separate protocol was the right thing to do, he set about making sure it got done. With a clean separation of the protocols, it was now possible to build fast and relatively inexpensive gateways, which would in turn fuel the growth of internetworking. By 1978, TCP had officially become TCP/IP. In 1973, just when Cerf and Kahn had begun collaborating on the concept of internetworking, Bob Metcalf at Xerox PARC was inventing the technological underpinnings for a new kind of network. Called a short-distance or local-area network, Metcalf's network would connect computers not in different cities, but in different rooms. Metcalf had received his undergraduate degrees in electrical engineering and management from MIT, and enrolled at Harvard for graduate school. But he hated Harvard immediately. "Harvard is full of old money people," he said. "MIT is full of no money. It was a class thing." Metcalf took a job at MIT where he felt more comfortable. The Institute was about to join the ARPANET, and he was assigned to build the interface between MIT's PDP-10 and its IMP. Harvard had a PDP-10 too, and Metcalf offered to make a duplicate interface to give to Harvard. But the networking people at Harvard declined the offer. "They said they couldn't possibly let a graduate student do something that important," said Metcalf. Harvard officials decided to have BBN do it. BBN in turn gave the job to its graduate student in residence, Ben Barker, who recruited John McQuillan, a fellow Harvard graduate student, to help him. Although enrolled at Harvard, Metcalf stayed at MIT to work on his dissertation, an examination of the ARPANET. When Metcalf submitted the work, Harvard rejected the finished dissertation as insufficiently theoretical. Too much engineering and not enough science, he was told. The rejection was embarrassing for Metcalf, who had just taken a job at Xerox Corporation's Palo Alto Research Center, after persuading his wife to leave her job to join him. He went to Xerox PARC anyway and began looking for a more theoretical topic for his thesis. Then, in 1972, while on DARPA-related business for PARC, Metcalf stayed at the Washington home of his friend Steve Crocker. Crocker had gathered together some of the best technical people from the early sites to assist new sites, and called these people network facilitators. Metcalf, who had become something of an ARPANET expert at MIT, was one of them. Crocker had just been visited by Norm Abramson, the primary architect of the Aloha Network at the University of Hawaii. On the night of Metcalf's visit, Crocker left one of Abramson's papers about the Aloha Network out. Metcalf picked it up and read it before going to sleep. The paper kept him up much of the night. "The math in the paper was not only familiar, but infuriating," he said, "because they made the typical inaccurate assumptions that people make so that their models work." Metcalf's chance encounter with Abramson's paper was to change his life. "I set out to make a new model for the Aloha system." Within a few weeks, he was on a Xerox-funded trip to the University of Hawaii. He stayed a month, and before coming home had added an extensive analysis of the Aloha system to his thesis. It was just the theoretical boost the dissertation needed. When he resubmitted the work, it was accepted. But the Aloha system gave Metcalf far more than a doctorate. Xerox PARC was in the process of developing one of the first personal computers, called the Alto. The company saw that customers would want to connect the machines, so Metcalf, one of the resident networking experts, was assigned the task of tying the Altos together. Without a store and forward model, preventing data packets from colliding was impossible. But simply scaling down the ARPANET by building a subnet of IMP-like store and forward computers would have been prohibitively expensive for a system designed to work in an office building. Metcalf had an idea, borrowed directly from the Aloha Net. In fact, he would call it the Alto Aloha Network. Let the data packets collide, then retransmit at a random time. But Metcalf's idea differed in several respects from the Hawaiian system. For one thing, his network would be 1,000 times faster than AlohaNet. It would also include collision detection. But perhaps most important, Metcalf's network would be hardwired, running not by radio waves but on cables connecting computers in different rooms, or among clusters of buildings. One computer wishing to send a data packet to another machine, say a desktop workstation sending to a printer, listens for traffic on the cable. If the computer detects conflicting transmissions, it waits, usually for a few thousandths of a second. When the cable is quiet, the computer begins transmitting its packet. If during the transmission it detects a collision, it stops and waits before trying again, usually a few hundred microseconds. In both instances, the computer chooses the delay randomly, minimizing the possibility of retrying at the same instant selected by whatever device sent the signal that caused the collision. As the network gets busier, computers back off and retry over longer random intervals. This keeps the process efficient and the channel intact. "Imagine you're at a party and several people are standing around having a conversation," said Butler Lampson, who helped Metcalf develop the idea describing the system. "One person stops talking and somebody else wants to talk. Well, there's no guarantee that only one person wants to talk. Perhaps several do. It's not uncommon for two people to start talking at once. But what typically happens? Usually they both stop. There's a bit of hesitation, and then one starts up again." Metcalf and Lampson, along with Xerox researchers David Boggs and Chuck Thacker, built their first Alto Aloha system in Bob Taylor's lab at Xerox PARC. To their great delight, it worked. In May 1973, Metcalf suggested a name, recalling the hypothetical luminiferous medium invented by 19th-century physicists to explain how light passes through empty space. He rechristened the system Ethernet. DCA, the ARPANET's caretaker, wasn't the only R&D agency in Washington to have grown bureaucratic. Nowhere in Washington could you walk into your boss's office anymore with a bright idea for a project and walk out 20 minutes later with $1 million in support. In the mid-1970s, the only organization that bore any resemblance to the ARPA of old was the National Science Foundation. The foundation was created in 1950 to promote progress in science by funding basic research and strengthening education in science. By the late 1970s, NSF was on the rise in the computing field. Not only was NSF a new likely source of sufficient funds, it was also the only organization whose officials could act on behalf of the entire scientific community. DARPA had provided the research base and new technology. Now NSF would carry it forward to a larger community. Officials at NSF had been interested in creating a network for the academic computer science community for some time. In a 1974 report, an NSF advisory committee concluded that such a service would create a frontier environment which would offer advanced communication, collaboration, and the sharing of resources among geographically separated or isolated researchers. At that point, NSF was mostly concerned with spurring the development of what was still a fledgling discipline. Perhaps because computer science was still an emerging field on most campuses, nothing much came of the notion. By the late 1970s, computer science departments had mushroomed. The advantages of the ARPANET were now clear. Rapid electronic communication with colleagues and easy resource sharing meant tasks that usually took weeks could now be finished in hours. Electronic mail created a new world of fast same-as-that, replacing the slow postal services and infrequent conferences. The network had become as essential to computer science research as telescopes were to astronomers. But the ARPANET was threatening to split the community of computer researchers into haves and have-nots. In 1979, there were about 120 academic computer science departments around the country, but just 15 of the 61 ARPANET sites were located at universities. Faculty candidates and graduate students alike were starting to accept or decline offers based on whether or not a school had access to the net, putting research institutions without